Maya Angelou once wrote, "The ache for home lives in all of us, the safe place where we can go as we are and not be questioned." Well, that's the dominating sentiment of my guest today on the program in his new song, "I Just Want to Go Home." So who is this homeward-wishing fellow, you're probably wondering? Well, sit tight in your home, and I'll tell you all about his. By the way, just so you know, when we talk, he's actually at home. Not wishing to be home, but already there. Why am I telling you this? I don't know. I just didn't want you to worry. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
The evening is ending. The band's going home. The party is over. I'm leaving alone. I just wanna go home now. Take the phone off the hook. Spend the night on my own. Maybe finish that book. See, I drunk myself sober. And I've smoked myself dry. And everyone is a stranger. Maybe that's why I just wanna go home now. Spend the night on my own. And someone drop me home now. Just wanna be on my own. Someone take me home.
That is the music of my guest today on the program, John Douglas. Let me tell you a little bit about John Douglas. So anyone who knows me knows I've been obsessed with the Trash Can Sinatra since 1990, and for good reason. The Scottish Outfit's winning discography, featuring albums like Cake, I've Seen Everything, Weightlifting, and In the Music, is a perfect body of work. From the punchy pop of Obscurity Knox to the sweeping rush of All the Dark Horses, the Trash Can Sinatra sound is shimmering and pastoral. They've toured rather extensively over the years, and they have an international fan base that cherishes every note they play. The recent reissue of Cake found their debut album hitting number 2 on the charts, and a new album is around the corner. In the meantime, guitarist John Douglas has just put out his debut solo album, and it's a stunner. A riveting 11-song collection featuring original material, a few Trash Can numbers, and a prefab Sprout cover of We Let the Stars Go, it's a stirring song cycle that's nostalgic, achingly beautiful, and emotionally precise. Douglas's delivery is gentle and thoughtful, and his phrasing features subtle flourishes that end up being unforgettable and deeply moving. And this conversation, super cool. He's such a nice guy. So here you go. Me and John Douglas of the Trash Can Sinatras having a conversation right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
I like the kind of northern end, I suppose, because the seasonal stuff, as far as, you know, if I was going to live somewhere, I'd live somewhere that had the seasons. But yeah, we've always had a good time in San Francisco. It's one of those cities you never get enough time. You know, there's a lot of lovely history there, and especially musical history, you know, and just a beautiful looking place.
When you're touring and you're sort of going from town to town, you must not get a lot of time in those places anyway, right? It must be hard to kind of really get a sense of what a place is like.
No, you get a glance, really. You get a small taste Generally, the area that you're staying or the venue. If you're lucky, you get a day off somewhere. I'm pretty sure I've had a day off or two in San Francisco over the years. There's a friend of ours lived there, a guy called Ricky, that plays with the Brian Jonestown Massacre. I seem to remember spending a day or two with him wandering around record stores. And but yeah, as you say, you know, it's a glimpse. I'd like to come. It's one of those places I'd like to come for a holiday with the wife, you know, and spend a couple of weeks getting to know it.
Do you think traveling as a young man, touring the way you did, what does that teach you, do you think, in terms of, because I find that when I'm with people who are well-traveled, they always know where to find a bathroom, they just have a sense of the world that people who haven't traveled don't. What did it teach you pretty early on and in terms of as a formative experience?
It was kind of good and bad. Not bad, I would never say it was bad. Little things that are recalled, like we grew up with a lot of the USA on TV, you know, of course, never having been there. So you get, you know, silly things like Kojak or whatever.
Right.
You know, as well as, you know, the kind of musical side of it. You know, there was a glamour to it and a kind of specialness to it. And then when you arrive in these places, you sort of, there's not disappointment, but there's like, oh, it's just like home. It's just like another place. You know, there's no big glittering stuff there. But you do get the taste of different cultures, and that's the beautiful thing. That kind of broadens the mind that way. You realize people are pretty much the same everywhere, generally struggling. Everybody seems to like a Friday night. You know, the basics are the same everywhere. Everybody wants to have a good time, the kids to be safe, a roof over the head. But the beautiful thing is the great histories you see everywhere. That's kind of probably why I like San Francisco more than other cities, because you can see the age in it. Mm. So it's a lot of America looks as though it was built yesterday. Some of the kind of cities are kind of similar, you know. But yeah, that's the beautiful thing about traveling, getting to see the ancient places and the different traditions, different foods and all that stuff. And, yeah, but underneath it all, there's just a resonance that we're all the same.
You're right about the U.S. The U.S. is such a young country. I think Eddie Izzard once said, I'm from Europe, where history comes from.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, your sense of things being new here, I think, is really accurate. I know that you're, in terms of, it's a new year, and I know that you finished 2023 pretty strong, you know, just with Cake and with your solo album. Like, it was a busy, cool time. And do you think, like, well, now what? now it's January. Well, now what do I do?
Well, no, we spent a lot of kind of doing a lot of backroom stuff last year as well, working on a new record. And we're about to do another recording session for the next couple of weeks. So that's kind of brewing and it's taking shape. So that's kind of exciting this year. That'll hopefully turn into something that's solid and we're happy to release. And I'm going to be out on the road doing some shows on my own, which I've not really done. I've done some support slots where I would do like 30 minutes or 40 minutes to someone else's audience, which was good. You know, I sort of learned a lot about standing there on my own with a guitar. So I'm kind of looking forward to going and people coming along to see me. You know, my name's on the ticket. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. It'll be a slightly different dynamic.
Like, you're using a different muscle than when you're playing with the band.
Yeah, it's a muscle that it's been very refreshing to use, actually. Not that I mean, I love being with the band. I've done it for so long. It's a beautiful place to be beside those guys on stage and in studio. You know, everybody brings their own thing to the table, and we concoct this stuff that's trash cans. But on my own, it's got a freshness to it. You know, there's no, I just do what there's, I don't have any sort of, I silence my inner critic, basically. Mm. and just do and allow things to happen the way I want them to. And to the rules of standing there just with the guitar and my voice, that's a lovely thing to just focus on and let it evolve. I'm quite committed to doing that. It's a, and then the nature of, I think when you do acoustic shows like that, people expect you to chat a bit more. Don't know if that's the same in the States, but here it's a sort of a, it seems as though it's part of the thing, which I really enjoy. I enjoy sort of setting the scene of a song, or, you know, setting the atmosphere a little bit. So the whole thing's like a new, I mean, I'm no spring chicken, and to learn something new is pretty good at my age, to start an apprenticeship. You know, it's yeah, pretty good, but very refreshing. Highly recommend it.
It just occurred to me now, after all these years of seeing shows, that when there's a guy or a woman on stage by themselves, there's an expectation between songs, that sort of interstitial conversation or chatter will be funny in some weird way or lively. Do you feel a kind of pressure to be amusing in those bits?
No, I never feel pressure. I find the whole thing very relaxing. After the first two times I did it, which were quite nerve-wracking, I relaxed into the space. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, I think the main thing is to be natural, and everyone, when they're natural, you know, is light-hearted at times. Even in our songs over the years, because some of them come from funny situations, other involved, you know. I don't know about pressure to feel funny, but it is good. It's a relaxing thing to say something and you hear a bunch of people laughing at it, and, you know, getting what you're saying. And I mean, the other side of the coin would be, if you don't do that, you're going to be quite serious in between songs. And I mean, that can only stretch so far, you know, in any conversation. You got to lighten it up a little bit.
Otherwise, I think I've seen Dylan a couple of times. He doesn't even know the audience is there. Just plays
I mean, Dylan's Dylan, you know, there's no one, when he walks in the room, there's no one else walks in the room like him. You know, he can do what he likes. He showed up. Yeah. That's the main thing.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. That's so true. But is there a kind of vulnerability to just being you without that sort of, without your guys with you, without the trash cans with you? You must have felt like that you were like going to battle without armor at first.
Yeah. Well, when I did go into battle, it was on terrain that I knew that people had no expectations of me. I was just the opening act for someone else, and when people weren't expecting to hear any trash can songs, there was no sort of history. So for me, that felt quite refreshing and healthy to learn how to do this in a place where I'm just playing to strangers and they accept me for what I'm doing in that moment. Yeah, it's kind of vulnerable in a way. I mean, if you fuck up, it's there's no one to blame. There's nowhere to go. No, I never think of doing that. No, I think it's a good place to be open. It's a good place to learn about yourself and what you think of the songs, and the song choices. Even when I started doing this, there were songs that I thought would really suit myself doing that, and it turned out they weren't. And the songs that I hadn't thought about that sort of became part of the set pretty quickly. I started writing a bit more. One of the reasons I started doing the acoustic thing was because I got a bit stuck. My head just got a bit, nothing was arriving. And I realized I had to give myself some sort of kickstart and get out of my comfort zone, if I have such a thing, and do something different. And it worked. It's the notion that I pick up the guitar now, I'm trying to hope for things that will arrive that will suit that format, just singing an acoustic guitar. I mean, I've always written that way on acoustic guitar, but you've always got the notion of a drummer. Or in the past, I would think, not in the past, Trash Cans is a notion where you think, well, this is good, we'll get a good groove with that, or this is a good pace, you know, and the band is always in my head. So for that not to be there has somehow freed the writing up. But yeah, going back to the playing gigs, yeah, it's a very vulnerable place. I mean, you're one person there and you're singing in a room. I mean, that in itself is quite a vulnerable thing. You're walking into a place and you're starting to sing. You know, my hat goes off to every singer that has the balls to do that. And once you get used to that place, it's a beautiful and vulnerable thing to do, you know, and the choice of material and what I'm doing becomes very, it's got to be things I can do with sincerity, you know, and you know, hopefully it comes across that way. So yeah, vulnerable is a good word for it. I'd go with that. Not like I'm you know, I'm not like the last leaf on a tree, you know, waiting to fall, you know, but there's a kind of, yeah, it's intimate. It's an intimate space, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's also really immediate because there's no like sonic architecture around you to absorb in. It's just, right, it's just like, here it is, me and a guitar.
Yeah, and that'll be it for the next little while, so get used to it. You know, you're not going to get any big, huge sonic shifts. You know, it'll be the songs. And I think within the songs, there's a lot of variety that you can cover. You know, there's a lot of emotions you can go near, and a lot of moods that you can conjure up.
You mentioned your inner critic. Are you a guy who, is your inner critic fairly loud, even when you're playing with the band? Are you somebody who's a little bit hard on yourself, or always sort of doing inventory of how you did?
Well, I think in the early days, that guy ruled. And then eventually I had a word. You know, I realized that things have to be allowed to come out, and they have to be allowed to take shape with positivity and enthusiasm. And perhaps after that, you might go, that's not going to fit, or there's other songs that are better than that or more. But you've got to allow things to come out. The inner critic can stop things happening, and that's kind of criminal. So, yeah, I mean, it's more, my inner critic can be, it's kind of, you know, like everybody, there's always a voice. You know, if you're watching on something on TV, you're going, this is bloody awful. Look at, you know, and you're judging the world all the time. And now and again, you know, I have to catch myself and go, geez, you know, shut up, man. Everybody's trying their best, you know. We're all doing our thing, you know. Aim that critique at yourself, and you win the last 5 minutes. So, yeah, the inner critic, I don't even know how useful it is in general. I wonder if it's like a possession thing, you know, a voice that's, you know, it's like utterly useless, really. You know, what's the inner critic for? You know, tell me a good, maybe there is a good side of man. I don't know, is there a good side to it? Don't know.
It depends on what he's saying.
Well, I mean, I think the critic is the funny word. I mean, I'll have things in my mind that will help me sculpt something a certain way. You know, I prefer this, and I like that, and I'll be drawn to that, and I'm not so drawn towards that. That's cool, and you know, I like all that stuff. But the thing that's just saying, you're crap, forget it, don't even try, you know, that voice, it's like, you know, but it's in there for a reason, I suppose, yeah.
You know, the thing that's interesting to me about the inner critic is the speed in which he shows up, because I'm a writer, and if I'm, like, I was working on something the other day, and I was, the inner critic showed up and went, that's terrible, and I thought, you know, when I come back and look at it in a few days, then there's a kind of the pace of editing is more natural. If you're doing it while you're writing it or while you're creating, it seems like it's not useful at all. It just seems like it's going to get in the way.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's got bad timing. Inner critic.
Bad timing. There it is. That's the thing about the inner critic. You just nailed it. It has bad timing. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think you're going to be critical when you're creating something. There will come a moment after creation when you sort of appraise what you did, and then you can work alongside the critic in a really normal way.
Yeah, I'll do things like, there's a thing I learned early on where if I'm playing my guitar, it's best if I get half conscious and not mean, not through any substance or anything, but I'll get like in the old days, I would get a cassette, like a C90 cassette, and I'd put it in the thing and I'd press record, so I knew at 45 minutes that were being recorded, so I didn't have to watch what I was doing. I didn't have to remember, oh, that's the good bit. I would just play and play, and afterwards I'd go 20 minutes ago, there was something, and I'd go back to, I'd listen to it and you know, and realize there was a half an idea or there was a chunky idea and just need to stretch out a little bit. So what was the question again? I got a bit lost there.
Just in terms of the duration of the critical impulse.
Yeah. Well, that sort of got rid of it because I knew that everything I did was being recorded. So there was no need to, if I was halfway through something, go, that's not going very well, stop. You know, because it's all something I can look back on with a cold eye. So, and I still find that to this day, the very, very good way of creating, just have something recording what you're doing and get half conscious, just allow yourself to forget what's going on. And generally that's when things arrive that are meaty and have a kind of resonance to them. It's like your subconscious talking or your you know, the thoughts of the day have simmered and been, what do you call it, been brought down to an essence that's coming out in a way that you wouldn't probably do if you're thinking about it. You know, to go down, sit with a pad and a guitar and go, I'm going to write a song about love, you know, forget it. Well, you might do something, but the better things are the things that I enjoy that seem to resonate with people are the things that come through that half, you know, allowing your subconscious to take over and you stay out of the way of it. And as I say, recording it seemed to me the perfect thing to do, because I wouldn't have to clock what was going on as it was happening.
Mm. It also seems like consciousness would block the sort of the unexpected.
Yeah, and as a poetry starts to happen, you know, and the conscious, I don't know if it's any good as being a poet. I mean, it can clock rhyme and all that. But yeah, there's something kind of inexplicable about that kind of little halfway land between being out of focus and being in focus. When you're totally out of focus, it's a mess. When you're totally in focus, it's dull, maybe. But something about the halfway thing that kind of, maybe that's just because that's the way we live our lives. You know, we're half here and half, you know, dreaming of other things. Yeah.
That's right. I talked to Frank maybe 12, 15 years ago. Uh-huh. And he said something which actually I think about all the time. He said that I was asking him about Cake, because Cake was such a, you know, such a enormous album in my life. I mean, it came out when I was like 20, and it just hit me in the way I needed to be hit. Okay. And I was asking him about it, and this must have been 2004 or something. Uh-huh. And he just, the only thing he said was, he said, so many words. and I remember thinking, like, yeah, when you're young, there is this kind of rush. I think my poems when I was 20 were 12 pages, and now they're just 5 lines. And so I think what he was hitting on is that as we get older, I think we become more discerning about what is necessary and what isn't necessary. I mean, to me, there's not one unnecessary moment on Cake, but the idea that as you become an older person and you mature as an artist, you can refine your art to a place where it's more stealth, and you can get to the heart of the matter faster. It's more economical. Have you found that with yourself, with the band, with your life, in every way? Don't you think that's kind of true?
Yeah, I think things, as life goes on, things get distilled down to their kind of essence. And certainly when you're young, you're, as you say, you're, you know, there's a lot of it's trying to impress. You know, there's a lot of insecurity going on. And you've got, the other thing with youth is your whole life can be devoted to something. You know, you might have a girlfriend, maybe, but nothing committed, got no kids, really got no career path or job to worry about. There's a free, big, huge expanse of page to fill, you know, and you feel maybe competitive as well, you know, with what's going on. There's a lot of, one of the driving forces of us being together was hating everything else that was around. Everything felt mediocre. The music we wanted to hear, we had to make, because there was people doing good things, but there was always something that they didn't do that right. And there was the odd band that was sort of, you know, perfect, and they would be your sort of linchpins that would keep you going in the world. But you're driven by a lot of anger at the mediocrity of the world, and you want to fill it up, and you want to show off, and you want to make your mark. And with us, I think our early, always the lyric was a big thing. For a lot of bands, it's not really. It's just something, they're glad somebody's doing it. You know, who was it I heard talking about that? John Taylor from Duran Duran was talking about how the main thing about Simon coming on board was he would just sing words. Instantly they could forget about it. Somebody was doing it. Didn't matter what they were, didn't care, as long as it sounded good, you know, sonically or whatever. Yeah. And I thought, actually, what a brilliant thing to say. You know, it's a real relief if somebody in a band is just going, I've got it covered. Don't worry about it. And we were kind of all big hands, at, you know, big lovers of lyric. So we were always kind of involved in the kind of the conjuring up. Frank was the main one in the early days of getting the whole thing together. But he knew the sort of you know, the aesthetics of us was about being verbose and being, you know, making sure everybody knew we were well read and we could say things that were in a slightly off-kilter way and try and twist things so they weren't their usual way of saying things. And the first record's kind of full of that. And to its, you know, I praise it for that. It's something I don't do anymore, and I don't think any of us do anymore. We don't mind, you know, as I say, twisting the words a little bit and making things sort of jar you out of, oh, what, you know, when a word, when a phrase comes out of a song, it just makes you stop. You know, there's something to be said for that. We still try and do that. But the early days of just trying to fling the kitchen sink at everything and eager to please, maybe that's not around so much. So, yeah, I think as you get older, you discover what you really enjoy and what you can leave behind. Yeah, things get as you say, the menu gets smaller but better. So yeah, I think that's probably true. As you get older, you try and make life less complicated and you focus on the things that are positive and that you enjoy, and everything else just becomes frivolous. Forget it. It's all right. You know, it's got to be something good about getting old, right?
Well, yeah. Short list, John, but yeah. I mean, I think that I remember, you know, I remember when I was in university, there was a girl I just loved, and I was chasing after her and writing poems for her. And then she ended up being my girlfriend, and I sat down to write and I couldn't write a word.
Ah, really?
Yeah. Because the pursuit of it inspired so much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you stick together for long?
I mean, maybe two and a half years. And It was the worst thing for my writing because I was sort of, for a time, I was, you know, I'd sort of gotten the thing I was chasing after. And then I thought, well, now what do you do? Now what happens? You know, writing about happiness certainly wasn't as interesting as writing about longing, I guess.
I think that, I think you're right. I mean, it can be done. And it has its place in the world. But yeah, longing, I mean, longing kind of is always there, you know, I think. Even if you find the most, I mean, I'm in a beautiful relationship, but I'm longing for it to be forever. You know, this notion of going and growing old and pass away, you know, that's crazy. But you accept it and all that. Well, I never found that. Writing was always a thing for me that... it was always a driving force. And when I was in big, long, beautiful relationships, that never stopped. You know, I would always find time to go away. And I guess one of the things was, I mean, and our subject matter wasn't always the love song or the pursuit of love song. There was other things we'd talk, you know, there'd be just comments on society or writing about friendships or, you know, the subject matter of songs still seems to me wide. Very wide, but yeah, I mean the writer's block never really happened until much kind of later on, where I got. There's been times where I couldn't come up with anything, but it didn't stop me trying. You know, I think if you show up to try and write something, eventually the dam breaks and you get stuff coming out again. But that's interesting, though. You're chasing this girl and then it stopped.
Yeah. Yeah, and then when she broke my heart, it started again.
There you go. Well, heartbreak's a belter. Heartbreak's a cracker, eh? So that'll bring up lovely thoughts and lovely turns of phrase, and everyone's got their own individual heartbreak and their own individual circumstances of that, which, you know, you write about that, and it's personal, and you think, oh, the details of that room and that time and those streets are all mine. But that subject matter's universal. You know, that's, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it doesn't really go away. When you actually, to be honest though, when it happened, I remember thinking, like, as sad as I was so happy to be writing the way I, you know, back to longing or back to pain. It almost felt like a comfortable place to be.
Okay. Well, that's good, because that means you're on your own two feet and you're, you know.
Right.
You're doing your thing.
You're doing your thing and you're back to your thing. Yeah, back to longing. Was in terms of being competitive, I like what you were saying about to hear the music we wanted to hear, we had to make it. But, you know, 1986 to 1990 in Scotland, I mean, good God, it was a gold rush of pretty brilliant people. It was a pretty, I would imagine it was pretty competitive in terms of looking around and seeing people who, I mean, everybody from Aztec Camera to, I mean, Orange Juice was before that, but to the Waterboys, I mean, to whatever. But the point was, there were a lot of great Scottish bands. Were you competitive with what was going on?
Let me think. Not in the sense of, oh God, they brought out a record, we need to do better than that. No, to be honest, at that time, when I think back on it in our early days, your Aztec Cameras were making kind of smoother records. Ones just the same. Liked Waterboys records. For some reason, I don't know, that you get inspiration from those people. Certainly Mike Scott was a lovely inspiration. Somebody ploughed their own path and stuck true to their character and for some reason got amazing success. Usually when you stick to your path and stay true to your character, that's way off the mainstream, that kind of thing. But he made it through doing that. Very prolific as well, which is another thing. I think one of the things we had on our side was we were very committed to the idea of a band. We all chip in, we all contribute, we all listen to each other's voices. And that's the thing. When I looked at Aztec Camera and Orange Juice and the Waterboys, they didn't have that. They had one guy hiring and firing people as they went, and the records I loved were things like The Clash and, you know, the Beatles and the Stones, and, you know, they were the kind of things that we, once we got together and had this chemistry that we kind of acknowledged, we realized this is a gang. This isn't one guy coming up with the songs and everyone just waiting to chip in their part. This is a sort of gang thing where we do this thing together that we can't do on our own, and who's doing that, you know? Even your REMs of the world and your Smiths, you know, people would see these are great songwriters, but they were contributory to the thing. You know, you knew that they're all a big part of the sound. They were some of the bands that we adored. REM was a big thing for us, you know, the as an inspiring thing. You could tell, I mean, as soon as one of them left, the sound radically shifted. Bill Berry, really? You know, and that'll be to do with his playing, but it'll also be to do with his input, sort of opinion wise. I'm sure all the guys would listen to each other and sort of the concoction of all those conversations ended up the REM sound. And we were very much the same thing, the concoction of everything we said about what we come up with, as well as the meat of what we came up with, was a group kind of effort. So and still is to this day. So when talking about competition, when I look back then, there probably wasn't a lot around that we thought were. It's more competition of, let's put some good music and get rid of this awful music we keep hearing on the radio, you know. Production was really tough back then. That kind of late 80s sound was, you know, just very studio production based, you know, horrible sounding drums and horrible sort of, it was the beginning, you know, what were they called? Samplers and all that stuff was coming in, and it was really, there was the odd record that like a production that could do it well, but most of it was just tough, you know, very tough to listen. Even bands I loved, when I listened back to the records they made in the late 80s, I'm like, God, there's not many people really survived that sonically, you know. Maybe I'm a bit of a purist that way of thinking there's a band, I just want to hear the band recorded well. Production is making sure that you're recording them well, you get the sound they're making on the record, rather than let's get the sound they're making and add treatments to it. So yeah, maybe I'm a bit of a purist that way. But that was the competition aspect. It was just, God, this jukebox is awful. Let's get some good stuff on it.
Right. Well, I remember hearing when I was 17, I remember Aztec Camera's Love came out. And at the time, I remember thinking, wow, this sounds very 1987 because it sounds so splishy and produced. And the songs are great, but it is, there's just so much production there that... really sort of gets in the way. But it's interesting what you're saying, because I can't name a member of Aztec Camera besides Roddy Frame, but I can name all the guys in the trash cans. And so there is a kind of cohesion to having the same people.
I think so. Well, I think it was Roddy and Campbell Owens was his friend from who played the bass on. I think it was Gone by Love, but he did the first album. He did Knife, and you could tell that they. We've got to know Campbell afterwards, and you could tell that they're very opinionated people, very much not afraid to say their opinions. But again, it was Roddy was writing all the songs, and Campbell was the very great bass player and added great character to the songs, and his bass playing is pretty irreplaceable. But Roddy walking away from that when you look back isn't really surprising. He's got an opinionated guy saying that one's not as good as that one, or that middle eight isn't as good as this. You get two choices, believe him, stick with him, and keep the thing going that you've got, the sound, or you say, right, forget it, I'm away to work with some other folk. And they chose that path, and there you go. I think they've made up since. I think they became friends since. I think it was a tough time for them. But yeah, there's something about a band and a group and the chemistry and people relying on each other that it's a kind of reflection of the world the way you wish it would be. You know, we all respect each other's things and we all make each other a bigger thing than what we do individually. And if we can all acknowledge that, it'd be a better place. Yeah.
Do you know Roddy at all?
No, did a show with them too. Very friendly, very nice, very complimentary. But no, he was up and out of town well before we were around.
Mm. Remarkable guitar player. Holy cow.
Unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable. From day one, from 15 years of age, first gig. It was early. It was stunning, absolutely stunning. The chord palette he used, I mean, fantastic, totally fantastic. Really, he'd probably be diagnosed something now nowadays, beyond some sort of spectrum. But you know, fantastic
to be that good, that young, and you know, to see what he's done now. We're talking about distilling it down, where it's just him and an acoustic guitar, which is what we were talking about earlier. And every note is just so subtle and so commanding.
Absolutely, and I think his voice suits that setting as well. I think he sings a lot better in that circumstance as well. But he's made some great records.
Throw me away into the past. That's where I stay. That's where I last. Soft as the grass, and long as the day. But I'm lost, babe. Baby, I'm lost, babe. I'm lost, babe. Baby, I'm lost. Old men who pray, what do they know? What's in the way? Where do we go? Long was the time, exhausted we lay. Now I'm lost, babe. Baby, I'm lost, babe. I'm so lost, babe. Baby, I'm lost. Long was the time, exhausted we lay. Out of the past, I can't find a way. And I'm lost, baby. Baby, I'm lost, baby. I'm so lost, baby. Baby, I'm lost, baby. So lost, baby. Baby, I'm lost. So lost, baby. Baby, I'm lost.
Just in terms of success of, like, you know, Scottish music, mid-80s, Simple Minds kind of blew the game open with New Gold Dreams, but Big Country were huge too, weren't they?
Oh yeah, they were huge. Yeah, they were. I mean, I was a big fan of the Skids, Stuart's band before that, and they did some good hit records. They kind of went not so good later on, or, you know, not so popular later on. But yeah, Big Country were huge straight away here. You know, the first records were smash singles, and again, kind of inspiring, you know, to hear as young guitar players growing up in Scotland, to see young Scotsmen with electric guitars being kind of unique with it. Not really bluesy, not really any kind of old cliched rock stuff. I mean, I think that's what we, like Paul and I in the early days, a bit like what I hear Johnny Marr talks about, we were attracted to guitar players that weren't that blue, that kind of nothing about blues. It was more melodic guitar playing. You know, that we're kind of attracted to. And then certainly Stuart had his own take on that, you know. Fantastic. Great sound.
Was he a monster player?
I don't know if he's a monster player, but he had a sound.
Yeah.
You know, he had a sound and he had a kind of aesthetic that he stuck to. I think in his later years, it might have become a bit of an albatross for him. He formed another band outside Big Country that were doing more rootsy sort of countryish things. Not to any great success, but I think for him it was a good outlet to get away from the big noise that Big Country were. Everything had to be rock. And I think that got a bit tiresome for him. But as a guitar player, I think it's a bit like a lot of the guitar players I like. They're not like shredders or maestros. They've just got a sound and they've got an attitude to the guitar that's their own. You know, generally, the things I like are the kind of melodic things. John McGeoch was another great guitar player that we both loved for Magazine and the Banshees and the Armory Show. Anywhere he showed up, he had that great sound of looking for melody, looking for interesting rhythm, looking for interesting sort of sonics, 12-string stuff, and all to suit the song, really. Yeah, those are the kind of, I suppose those are the guitar players that we were kind of drawn to back then in that mid-80s time, just getting away from Americana and more into just melody and maybe a more European take on it. I don't know, really.
Well, did John Squire do anything for you?
John Squire, no. Again, that was one of the things. God, if I run a record label, I'd have walked past him. You know, not really. Until Fool's Gold, I just heard things that didn't really bother me. You know, I tip my hat to him, yeah, great guitar player. And the band had a great sound, great drummer, good bass player, but at the time it didn't really grab me. Nothing lyrically, you know, lyrically there's nothing there that I could see was, you know, up my street. So that's probably the major thing for me. You know, somebody's lyrically not really doing it for me. I find it hard to get past that. But yeah, that's a great guitar player. I take my hat off to him. He's good. And Fool's Gold's a bit of a classic record. I'm sure there's probably a handful of others, but for me to see them and think they're going to be like the biggest band in the world, There's no way I would have imagined that. And there you are. That's how off I can be.
I love the inclusion of the Prefab Sprout song on the album. I love that band so much. And, doing a song like that, did it also, when you're sort of picking it apart and figuring it out, did it also make you kind of realize the sort of genius of that composition and that band? Or I'm sure you already knew that, but it must have really given you a...
I knew that. I knew the genius from day one whenever Swoon came out. You know, it just mind-blowingly different from anything else. And then the next, Steve McQueen, was a total step, into brilliance. You know, and the singles and the B-sides and protest songs and everything that they do. So much of it is great. His voice is wonderful. You know, he could sing any song to me, and I'd adore it. I'd love him to do an album of covers just because his voice is so good. But yeah, I knew they were a sort of complex band as far as chords go and arrangements go. So I'd never even thought about covering any of the songs until Jordan came out. And then amongst all the big sort of ambitious and songs, there was this beautiful little love song about an old flame. And it seemed really simple, chordally, even though the bass is doing some fancy stuff. So I went and got the chords, and they were just three or four chords. And I was going busking at the time. So I learned it and I would sing it. And it was a song that would stop guys my age, you know, in the street, and they go, oh, God, that song, you don't hear that anywhere. And that's one of the best songs because it's so personal, you know, and it's so kind of uncomplex and uncomplicated, just somebody referring to an old flame and how they can burn bright, but you're kind of glad they're not around, you know, reminiscing on a time like you were, you know, very simple. But yeah, as far as learning anything about that chordally, no, I think what I learned was, oh God, why did that hit me so much? Maybe it hit me a lot because the subject matter, absolutely. But also chordally, it was quite simple. It wasn't a lot of fancy stuff going on there. And I went to see Martin McAlooney's brother, did some shows over here recently. Fantastic. I didn't know what to expect, but he was brilliant. And it drove home the complication and the chordal stuff. It sounds really simple, but you watch his hands at times, think, my God, there's the stuff that's going on in there. And he showed me some things that were in We Let the Stars Go, where I'm sort of not doing what's on the record. And I'm like, well, and I was like, well, you know, I'm doing it the way I want to do it. Sounds good to me. And he's going, no, it's good what you're doing. He just wanted to show me the kind of intricacy of the work that goes on and within their songs. But yeah, I mean, very special writing, Paddy McAleen, amazing.
So Martin, this is embarrassing because they're one of my favorite bands, but Martin was the guitar player, not Paddy.
No, Martin's a bass player.
He was the bass player. Okay.
Yeah. So that, yeah, it's a strange concept. He was doing some gigs, but basically what happened was he announced some shows and he said he'd be playing Paddy songs. And I thought, what the heck's that going to be like? And I don't think he's a great singer or anything. And I went to see him. In fact, he invited me down. He'd saw me on YouTube doing a cover of We Let the Stars Go. And he was playing, one of the first gigs he did was in my hometown in Irvine on the west coast of Scotland. And he got there and he mentioned to the guys that were running the show, do you know John? Because I know he's from here. And he'd sung a version of this thing. And they said, yeah, you know. I said, could you give him a call and ask him to come down and would he come and sing it with me? So I was like blown away. I get this call. So I drove down and had a quick rehearsal with him at half time. He did two long sets. And then I got there at half time, so I still didn't know what he was going to be like. I did this rehearsal with him at the half time, and then he went on. And he was wonderful. And the guy who ran the show said, the first thing he said was when he came on stage, he says, see in this room, I know yous all think you love the songs of Paddy McAleen, but none of yous come close to loving them the way I do. And that's, so he's playing him like a fan and talking about the journey, you know, how they started and the stories behind them. And he sort of speaks, he's got a beautiful sort of vulnerability to his voice. He doesn't try and imitate Paddy, but he is kind of like him because they're brothers. And it's wonderful. It's just a wonderful, very moving show, very, very moving. And the amount of material he plays, he takes requests. One of the things he did was, have you heard I Troll the Megahertz?
Yeah.
You know the sort of sampled conversation in that? There's bits. Paddy says the inspiration he got for making that was when he was blind. He went blind for a while and he listened to a lot of the radio. And one was this documentary, a radio show documentary about a woman who was getting divorced. And he took some of the dialogue from that and put it in I Troll the Megahertz. And one of the lines is it was the woman splitting up with the man and she has to explain it to the kids. And she says, listen, your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore. You know, really heart, you know, beautiful line. And during the gig, Martin McLean starts playing the melodies from I Troll the Megahertz. And he's up to the mic and he says, you know, Paddy loves you. He just doesn't want to play live anymore. But a show that's full of little details like that, really beautiful. If he ever comes to San Francisco, it's a total must. You have to go and see him. It's fantastic. Totally fantastic.
Did you guys strike up a friendship? Or are you still in touch with him?
Well, kind of over the social media. I knew him vaguely because we toured with the Prefab Sprout when their Jordan record came out over here. We were the support act for the UK tour. So we played maybe 12 shows with them up and down the country. Kind of got to know them a little bit, you know, in the bar after the show. Mostly Martin and Neil, the drummer. Sometimes you'd see Wendy. Paddy was never, he would do the show and cut and go straight to the hotel. But we got to know Martin a little bit and they got to know us a little bit. So I was kind of on his radar a little bit. And because I'd done this cover and my record had come out just before he was doing these shows. And also the similarity of, you know, him stepping out, not being known as the singer and going doing a few shows. That's exactly what I was doing. So it was a kind of karma thing. I think things just seemed right. But I was, yeah, it was to get a phone call saying Martin wants you to come down. It was pretty special, you know.
That's pretty cool. That's really cool. How is your, in terms of daily discipline, do you play every day? Are you one of those people, or do you put it down for a while, or do you try to just really, you know, check in with your instrument every day?
Every day's tough. I mean, life's busy, you know, family things and all that. But I do have I've got a little space that I share with some other musicians. It's like a lock-up garage kind of thing. Well, it's got electricity and there's no neighbours. It's warm and there's a little, you know, there's a sink and a kettle and that kind of stuff. And there's some jazz musicians in Glasgow that use it to rehearse in. And they had a space in their calendar for somebody to come in and chip in. So I chip in, pay a little bit of monthly rent and we run a little, you know, online calendar thing and I'll book it. You know, I'll be down there maybe two or three times a week. And I'll, because there's no, you know, it's like I'm going out of the house, getting away from the phone ringing and the door going and the shit. Because I'm in the house and locking the door somewhere else and there's no neighbours, so you're kind of not self-conscious about making a noise. I've got a little computer thing set up where I can multi-track. Yeah, that's what I do as much as I can. I wouldn't say daily because there's just a lot of stuff. And I'm a working musician as well. My wife's a singer and I play in her band, so we go on tour quite a bit and I've started doing these solo shows. And there's a lot of stuff, you know what it's, you know, when the house is always stuff to be done, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting this place was a bit of a godsend. I tried for a couple of years just doing stuff in the house because we've got kind of, you know, a couple of rooms, but it just became untenable. You know, there's just stuff goes on. There's always stuff to do in the house. So I made that decision a few years back to go and get a place. And when I leave the house, I'm going to work and I go and sit on my guitar and just do the thing I explained earlier. I'll just press record and play and play and get a bit lost and the thoughts of the day and the music, the whatever's coming up, and it tends to result in things that turn into songs.
Well, there is a thing about working from home, which has become, because of the digital age, it's so easy to work from home now. But people who work from home tend to go to cafes because it's like you want to keep your space, your house space, and your creative space or your workspace. If they start to blend, it probably isn't the best thing anyway.
Yeah, that's what I found. I found it was self-defeating. You know, you would end up getting annoyed at having to do stuff around the house and your creative stuff would get stifled because you were you know, you couldn't really turn, you couldn't turn into it. You couldn't turn it on and go, I'm doing this now, because the bell would, the door would go, or the phone would go, or there was something you'd have to go and get or whatever. So yeah, I think you're right there. I think it's better to have somewhere to go and feel like you're, when you leave the house, you're going to do something as well. There's a nice positivity to that.
I imagine my romantic idea of your life, though, is that you live in a creative household. You know, it's like, you know, so you know, your wife doesn't sell real estate. She's a musician, too. And it's like, and a very well-known one. And so I imagine that that there's a lot of creative energy, at least floating around.
Well, there's a lot of creative. There's always is. I mean, every day's fun and brilliant. Our boys are very musical as well. There's two boys in the house at the moment. Not boys, they're men now, you know, they're growing, but they, you know, they've got their own. Sam, our youngest, he's got a little studio set up. He makes his own kind of music, and it's very creative. But the other side of that is other, we have to take on the mantle of running the house and doing the stuff, you know. And so it's creative and it's healthy, but I think having somewhere to go is the healthiest thing to do. And come when I'm devoted, when I'm here in the house, I'm just doing the house stuff, which is brilliant, you know. But yeah, it's very creative family, absolutely.
Yeah. Did I see you guys are going to Japan?
My wife is. She's going to her band that she was in years ago, Fairground Attraction. They're going to do some shows in the summer in Japan. So yeah, she's very excited about that. And that's very a wonderful thing to have.
So you're not playing in the fairground?
No, they've got sound. They're one of those things where the drummer Roy, he's like a jazz drummer, but he's got his own thing. And the bass player Simon, again, he's got his own thing. And Mark, the songwriter, he plays guitar in such a way that they hadn't been together for a good 20 years, and they got together to rehearse and Mark had some new songs, and the sound arrived just like that. You know, with new songs, it's suddenly there they are. You know, there's that thing you cannot get anywhere else. That's what you four guys, people do. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing that they've got that sound up again. It's fantastic.
I started listening to them when I was 18. I remember the first of A Million Kisses, and I went, well, this is just a fantastic album. I'd never heard anything quite like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's timeless as well. There's not a lot of production stuff on it. And their whole attitude was, you know, just the acoustic instrumentation and then whatever we can conjure up on the room, in the room. And it's a beautiful, timeless record. The songs are, you know, top range, classic songs. So I'm so happy. She's so happy that they're back together to do some shows.
It's one of the purest albums I've ever heard, just in terms of energy and purity. It's hard to beat.
I think they felt as though they were going against the grain at the time. There's a lot of electronic music going around in the UK at the time. And they felt, Eddie's all, she's a big PF fan and Brel and all that stuff and loved acoustic music. She started off a folk. Her folk was her initial thing, and she met Mark and they conjured up this sound, which was against the grain of everything that was going around, but they loved it, and so did the world when they got to hear it. You know, fantastic record.
When you now look at your album, you kind of go like, well, I could probably do another one of these. Or has that crossed your mind?
You mean the acoustic, the solo thing?
Yeah, maybe. Have you thought about doing another solo album?
I'm still in the same frame of mind where I think the reason I did the record was basically because I was doing shows, and the reason I was doing shows is because I wanted to get back to writing and do something. And the record, I wanted, if somebody came to see me and they bought the CD or the record, it would be, you know, it would represent what they saw, a guy with an acoustic guitar doing his thing. And I'm kind of thought I do really enjoy that format. So yeah, I in an ideal world, if I had if I get enough songs together, I'm in writing mode just now, and also we're doing the Trash Cans record. You know, these things karmically will happen or they won't. I've got the plan would be to do another one, yes, absolutely, by the end of this year. I would love to do one. It's quick to do, it's cheap to do, you know, there's not a lot of decisions have to be made. It's just all down to the material. You know, I've got the guy that Mark, that Freeguard that recorded me, brilliant. You know, you got my guitar sounding great, you got my voice sounding good. So I've got a set up there where if I can get the songs to a stage where I like them with just me sitting singing and playing them, I could go and record it in a day, and you know, yeah, no problem. So yeah, that's it's not off the menu, Exactly.
Good, yeah. I was thinking about a band like Rush or U2 or Green Day or the Trash Cans. I think you know where I'm going with this, where it's the same personnel. Yeah. And you know, it may not sound like a big deal to the listener, but it is a big deal to keep the same people. I think Green Day swapped out a guy early on. But for the most part, these are the same people. And there's a confederacy in a band, which I think shows up on record. You mentioned Bill Berry. As soon as he left that band, I almost found them unlistenable, which shocked me. I couldn't really get into them anymore, even though I love them still. Yep. But I realized how important he was. And I didn't realize it at the time. Yep. How have you managed? You may not have an answer for this, but how have you managed to keep the same, the friendships going, the creative partnership going? It actually is a pretty big achievement.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all pretty chuffed that we're still here and we're still in good terms with each other. And still, it's, you know, the creative sort of process is exactly the same as it was back in the day. I think we just had a healthy respect for it, the notion of a band and what we were bringing to it. We realized, you know, the first records we made were totally, you know, us all chipping in ideas, and Frank would be like the director who would turn and who would get that and turn it into a song. And over the period, we all learned to do that individually. You know, well, you know, sometimes I'll bring in a fully finished song, sometimes it'll be like a verse and a chorus, or sometimes even a feel. But they all get chipped into this pot, and everybody can add to it or subtract to it, and that process, which was began early on, it served as well. And you know, we're always avid sort of students of other bands. You know, if there's a band going about, you like, you get all that, you watch, see all the documentaries, you get all the sessions, you get all the bootlegs, you read all the interviews, you do all your research. You know, and you think, is this just me being a fan? But no, you're really investigating how these people work, and how committed they are to it. How they committed they are to each other, and how that matters to the sound. Like, to learn early on that like REM split all the royalties, and I think U2 did the same. And yeah. Then you look back at the Beatles and you go, they didn't do that, and there was trouble because they didn't do that. Even trouble like with Lennon McCartney became that they'd write their own songs, and you could see in the interviews that he's fed up that he's not getting credited for that. So you'd see trouble. So early on, you learn, like, everybody, we're on the same page here, so we'll all credit everything, no matter who brings in whatever. And it served as well, because it was not that we got to the degree of fame or income that any of these acts had. No, you have your dreams at the start, but, you know, we've never had to deal with that side of things, of huge amounts of money coming in. But we'll have to deal with the notion of being a band that we all love and what that entails. So you learn over the years, you know, you'd be looking at somebody going, God, that's really annoying me, or that's not right, that's not correct. And then you'd go away and you'd look at yourself and you go, geez, there's things that I do that must annoy him as well. You know, and there's habits that I've got into, which I can see being a pain in the ass for people. You know, and it's a great sort of mirror, you know, to have a constant presence in your life. For some people, it's family. They have a constant presence in their life, or, you know, maybe old friends of from school days, and that kind of mirroring thing where it's truthful. You know, it's a precious thing to have out with music. You know, somebody that's just been there and seen you when you were at your lowest or your highest, or when you were making mistakes, or when you were being on a roll and you were rocking, and they remind you of it all when you need reminding. So there's a lot of that stuff which is precious. That's apart from the music. But yeah, I think there should be medals for this sort of thing. You know, through thick and thin, you stick together for a common goal. And, you know, if we think the records are stand the test of time, and there's a lot of people who has been the soundtrack to their lives. So, you know, it's not as though we're doing this in a vacuum. You know, I think if we'd had no connection with an audience, this would probably be a different tale. But from day one, there was a connection with people that adored what we did. It meant stuff to them. It wasn't like a dance floor filler or a tune they'd whistle for a couple of weeks. There was a sort of deep love for what we did, and every record seems to have the same reaction from people, that it's a You know, who was it? Paul, I remember there was a guy, one of the guys in America that looks after our sort of back stuff. He was asking people after shows, like, what do you like? And he'd go, I like jazz and I like you. Another guy go, I like Springsteen and I like you guys. I like you too and I like you guys. You know, we were in sort of good company, you know. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, very good company. And also at the root of it, aren't you, you guys are also just friends, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like Frank's coming over. He's arriving here Monday. We've got to do some work in the studio and, you know, we'll probably have a few nights out. You know, that kind of thing. Steve and my brother's here. We'd always, you know, we'd go for a pint, watch the football. Davey, I don't see so much, but when we do, it's great. He works at the post office and he's got kids, so he's quite busy family-wise. Paul, you know, he lives in Tacoma up north and he's happily there with his missus, so we don't see him as much. But, you know, anytime we do, it's just like the same as it. It's just like back to the same dynamic arrives, you know, and he'll tell you what he's been reading or what telly he's been watching. You know, I'll send little things. Like I saw a thing the other day. There was a wee guy on YouTube and he was an acoustic guitar player. And it was fascinated by Nick Drake. And he got his technique down. He'd got that brown, but he was getting into things like this is where the mic is on this particular song. And his hand isn't over the sound hole. His hand's behind the sound hole. And you'd notice these little sonic differences. And I thought, well, this wee guy's totally fantastic. So I sent that to Paul and he's like, oh, brilliant, man. What a great thing. So yeah, there's things that we will always be in touch about. And we'll always, but yeah, we're friends. Right?
Does the road still have an appeal to you to like go out and disappear for a while on the road? Or does that seem like a tiring proposition?
Yeah, I mean, it's a... I think if, you know, again, that's one of those things. If circumstances were slightly different, it'd probably be okay. You know, if we could tour in some sort of comfort, you know, and it wasn't a slog, yeah, it'd probably be good. But I suppose the last bunch of times we've done it, it's been tough, you know. We did a few acoustic tours, just myself and Davey, and myself and Frank and Paul. We did that two or three times all around the States, just in a van. And the shows were fun. The shows were great. But it was really tiring, you know, a long, long drives and quite, you know, it was in the space of a month. It's a long time you're away and we've all got home lives that we love. We're not getting any younger, you know, we're creaking a little around the edges. I've had a few kind of health issues, but I'm all right now, touch wood. But yeah, I think our general kind of attitude to playing live these days, as it has been for the past few records, is if we bring out a record, we should honour the release of a record by doing some shows somewhere. Whether it's just two or three. And the nature of people's commitments, that's probably all we can do at the moment. And, you know, unless there's a huge change and we start earning a load of money out of the music where people can take time off from their earning elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. I'm sure we'll do some shows, but where or when or how, I don't really know. I've always been the kind of, out of the band, I think I've been the sort of troubadour guy. I do enjoy playing and seeing people react to the songs and yourself getting lost in the songs and seeing, and they take on a different life when you're playing them live. So I kind of love that environment. I think that's where songs are at the peak. I think that's where they're kind of appreciated in a lovely way. Whereas some of the other guys would be like, oh, I much prefer the studio and sculpting the records. I could do that for the rest of my life and wouldn't miss the road or playing at all. So I would probably be more, you know, knocking on the door, hey, come on, let's get some shows. But yeah, I don't know, see what the future holds in that one. I don't know,
because also America is really spread out, so if you're playing San Francisco and then you're playing Seattle and you have a van, that's a long drive, and it's backbreaking to especially at our age, to sort of get into a van and drive, you know, 12 hours to a venue. It's like, that almost seems not tenable at all.
Well, yeah, it isn't really. I think we've sort of proved that to ourselves, you know, that's those days are gone. As much as we kind of enjoyed each other's company and enjoyed playing the shows, and you got lovely memories of it, but you've also got these, I mean, when you say that, 12 hours to San Francisco, yeah, great, but you're doing that for a month to various places, and And when we've done them, we kind of know it a lot now, the states or the various sides of it, the various kind of different parts of the country. So that kind of excitement of seeing different places is not there either. You know, we've kind of seen a lot of it. But as you say, there's a little snow on the mountain, as the Irish say, so we're getting a bit old.
But I saw you at Cafe du Nord in San Francisco in, must have been 2008 or something like that, and it was just absolutely packed. It must be really gratifying, though. It makes the toil kind of worth it to go like, oh.
Absolutely. That's the thing that makes it all worthwhile. And meeting people after the show or even before the show and just hearing people's tales of where they are in life and what they're doing and how much your songs mean to them. And, you know, the fact they're so buzzing that you're in town, you know, we're these kind of like rare birds from Scotland. You know, they fly through once every 3 years and, you know, it's a big night when they appear. I'm like that here. You know, if somebody comes to town that's rare, you know, I'll be like, wow, they're in town. Let's go see it. That's the thing about shows. It's about connecting with people and just seeing physically what the music does to people. It's hard to beat.
Yeah. And so the new album is maybe will come out at one point this year.
That's the plan. You know, we're certainly working on it as if that's what's going to happen. An ideal world, we'd have it out in the autumn. That's probably realistic. There's a lot of stuff kicking around. And we've kind of, I think the past few years, we were sort of just got a bit swimmy. There was so much material going around that was unfinished. We needed a bit of guidance. So we got in touch with Paul Savage, who's works at KM19, Chemical Underground Records. He produces a lot of records these days, and we asked him if he would come on board in a production role, and what we would do is just send him all the kind of ideas we've got and where we're at, and for him to just soak it up and come back and say, focus on that, focus on that, focus on that. And that's been kind of working well so far. We were third recording session with him. There was some stuff we have on that we had recorded that we just need mixed and maybe, I think, lyrically sort of worked on a little bit. But yeah, there's just a lot of stuff going on, and it's at the stage where I can't focus on how it's going to sound, but there's a million things kicking around. And over the next, maybe, Frank's over a couple of weeks, it'll become a bit more focused, and then probably in the summer we'll have another session like that, and ideally it'll be ready to go by the autumn. There's some brilliant, I'm really happy with the stuff we've got so far.
Excited to hear it, and I love your album, and I'm so happy to talk to you. I'm so grateful that you took this time to chat.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you very much. I'm glad you like the record.
I love the record. Yeah, it was a really great surprise. I didn't know it was coming, and all of a sudden I saw it come through on my desk, and I went, "What?" and I just think it's marvelous. It's just really beautiful work.
Glad you like it. It was fun to make, and it was quick, and it was the same for me. I didn't know there was going to be a record, and then I thought, why not? And then next thing you know, I've got one in my hand. So yeah, fantastic.
A job well done. And man, thank you for this, and have a great weekend.
You too, Alex. Thanks for chatting.
Lovely guy, John Douglas. What a cool dude. Great conversation, great album. Go get it. TrashCanSinatras.com or johndouglas.bandcamp.com. Those are the ways to get that album. You're going to love it. It is just spellbinding. So do pick it up, sit back, and marvel at the beauty of this album. No beauty to marvel at with me, but you can still visit me at alexgreenbooks.com. No beauty, just books. Pick up my new one, The Adventure Teen All-Stars. It's out in paperback now. You can follow me on what's left of Twitter, at Embers Editor, or on Instagram, at Embers Podcast, or just email me, editor@stereoembersmagazine.com. Don't forget to check out bombshellradio.com. And remember, not that you would forget, Stereo Embers, the podcast, is available on all podcast platforms, just like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe for free, tell all your friends, rate and review if you have a minute. We'd appreciate it. Let's take a longer listen to John Douglas's I Just Want to Go Home from his absolutely terrific debut solo album. Enjoy it, and thank you as always for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.
The evening is ending, the band's going home, the party is over, I'm leaving alone. I just wanna go home now, take the phone off the hook, spend the night on my own, maybe finish that book. See, I drunk myself sober, and I've smoked myself dry, and everyone is a stranger. Maybe that's why I just wanna go home now, spend the night on my own. Won't someone drop me home now? Just wanna be on my own. Someone take me home. Someone home now, spend the night on my own.